Good evening, everyone. How many of you know that when you signed up to come to Bethel, you knew that part of the fun of this whole church was that you never know what to expect? What did Forrest Gump say that is true of this church? It's like a box of chocolate with a few vanilla creams. No, you never know what you're going to get. And you know, last night we had a special event at the Global Cafe where Pastor Dave and Christy hosted an event, really one of the next phases in the long, just an amazing trek and odyssey of God knitting the hearts of people of the Jewish faith with the Christian community. And some of you have known that we have hosted many events in our home with Knesset members. We just had one just a few days ago with Gila Gamliel, actually the youngest woman in the Knesset, and a tremendous spokesperson for the kind of values and things that it was just a wonderful, wonderful message at our home. And last night, we had the special treat at the Global Cafe of Rabbi Lappin from Seattle. And I referred to his book last night, Rabbi Daniel Lappin, America's Real War. An Orthodox rabbi insists that Judeo-Christian values are vital for our nation's survival. So, let me read. These are not my glasses. These are my wife's glasses, so they're a little small. So I kind of feel like what King Kong might look like if he was trying to read. It has that weird feel. Rabbi, this probably isn't the best of... I'm just picking out a passage that I think would best epitomize what the Lord's going to do tonight. In the pages following, I will argue that America is a religious nation and that corresponding interpretation of our history and culture is the correct one, that corresponding interpretation. But I shall go much further than that. America is not just religious, but it is rooted in one particular religious tradition. As an Orthodox rabbi, I will make a compelling case for America as a Christian nation and the need for our nation to be based on Judeo-Christian ethics. In other words, it's Judeo-Christian because we got our Bible from those of the Jewish faith. They are our older brothers. They are the ones that gave us the book. Can you say amen? Based on Judeo-Christian ethics, in order to survive, despite the fact that Judaism and Christianity have totally different theologies, there is still one Judeo-Christian ethic, which is to say that how people order their lives in societies, how they organize their families and behave toward one another, turns out to be more similar than different. The origins, legal system, ethos, and moral sense of America are entirely Judeo-Christian. And so, referencing back to the picture on the front of the book of the tug of war over the American flag, a Jew and a Christian at one end of the rope have more in common with one another in terms of vision for this country than each may have with his co-religionist at the other end. This is because the tug of war is not about theological or philosophical differences, but about real life disagreements about things like taxes, crime, welfare, and family life. No matter what the philosophy of belief that brings us into our view of how things ought to be, we tend to agree with others holding the same view, regardless of the belief that brought them to that view. And so tonight, I believe this is an historic moment for us in this theme of rising to the challenge and reading. This was a book that I had on my bookcase from the year 1999. And when I found out Rabbi Lappin was in town, I just couldn't believe it. Pulled the book out and said, I've got the book, honey. And I began to read the book to my wife. Rabbi Daniel Lappin is an Orthodox rabbi, businessman, author, and syndicated talk show host and speaker. He is the president of Torah Tradition, a nonprofit educational organization, and founder of Cascadia Business Institute. He and his wife, Susan, who is here tonight, live in the Seattle area where they homeschooled their seven children. Wow, that is an accomplishment. And Rabbi, let me say, it is an honor to have you here to speak to us tonight. You not only speak to us here, but those that will listen throughout the world as they receive these tapes in some 50 countries. I want you to know that it is an honor that you are a friend of the Christian church. And we are here tonight to stand and say that we are a friend of Israel, a friend of the Jewish community. Would you welcome to Bethel World Outreach Center, Daniel Rabbi Lepin.
Thank you. Don't want to eat into my time. I've only got a little time with you this evening. Thank you, Pastor Rice. And it truly is a pleasure being here with you, because the Bible tells us that cowardice is contagious. That's why the rule in Deuteronomy is that any soldier before a battle who feels fear must do what? Go home. We don't need you among the warriors, because if you feel fear, you will spread it. Fear is contagious and cowardice is contagious. But my friends, courage is equally contagious. Hang around people with courage and some of it spreads onto you. And you are blessed with a courageous pastor. And so I decided to spend as much time as I could. And instead of leaving Nashville this afternoon, I decided to do my best to persuade him to let me hang around. And that way, I would catch a little of his courage. Now, I know what you're thinking. Look into my eyes so I can read your minds. Look carefully and I will read it. No, don't look away. I know what you're thinking. Ma'am, I know what you're thinking. I know exactly what you're thinking. You're saying to yourselves, now what on earth is an Orthodox Jewish rabbi doing in Bethel Church? That's what you're thinking. Well, first of all, the very name Bethel, house of God. In what language? Norwegian? Albanian? Patagonian? I don't think so. Bethel, Bet-El, house of God, in the Lord's language. Lord's language is Hebrew. And let me tell you, if you don't have Hebrew down cold, as perhaps some of you may not yet have, why, you need a rabbi. Now, let me paint a picture for you. From July the 4th, 1788, there was an Independence Day parade through the streets of Philadelphia that year, as every year. 1788, the country is yet young. And one of the signers of the Declaration of Independence was the only doctor, the only physician who signed the Declaration of Independence. His name was Dr. Benjamin Rush. He was a faithful Christian. And he wrote on July the 9th, 1788, he said, seeing a rabbi of the Jews marching arm in arm with two ministers of the gospel was a most delightful sight. A more happy emblem could not be imagined. An emblem means something that shows the way to the future. Benjamin Rush understood that a special friendship and a special relationship, such as between Pastor Rice and myself, such as between Jews and Christians who follow the word of the boss, a special relationship, a brotherhood of destiny between America and Israel. For after all, there have been only two nations in the history of humanity that have been founded on an idea, not on real estate. Only two nations in the world that have founded on an idea and not on racial identity. The two nations, ancient Israel and modern America. And in both those nations, people could be gathered from the four corners of the earth and could become part of these nations. And so, on what I think of as one of the proudest days of my life, when I became an American citizen, the founding fathers became my fathers because I shared the ideal. Both nations crossed an ocean to escape oppression and find religious freedom. Ancient Israel crossed the Red Sea to find the Promised Land, and modern Americans crossed the Atlantic to find some measure, ultimately, of freedom here in the United States of America. And so there really is something very special. There is a relationship, and my friends, Beth El is the house of God in Hebrew. But I wonder if you know not one but two words for friend in Hebrew. The first one is yadid. That means friend, my friend. And I want to tell you how it is spelt in Hebrew. It is spelt in a way that is made up of two separate words, or if you like, one word repeated. What am I talking about? The Hebrew word for hand is a yad. Now, if you put hand next to hand, you get two yads, yad, yad, and that's how the word friend in Hebrew is written. Now, for pronunciation reasons, it's not pronounced yad, yad, it's pronounced yadid, because that makes it tighter and shorter. But it's spelled yad, yad. Have you ever wondered why it is that the universal symbol of friendship among all human beings, when they meet one another and they want to express friendship, is a handshake, a hand clasping a hand? Now, some people will foolishly tell you that the reason for that is because, you see, everybody used to walk around armed with their swords. And so if they put out their right hand and the other guy put out his right hand, why, it would show that you were in no fear. I don't know about you folks, but I can do a pretty good knife job with my left hand. And wouldn't the guy I'm shaking hands with be surprised? So it means nothing at all. That's not the reason that human beings shake hands to express friendship. They shake hands to express friendship because in the Lord's language, which once upon a time everybody knew, it says in chapter 11, before the Tower of Babel, and the whole land was one what? One language. Right. What was the language? And if you look inside that Hebrew text, we need a rabbi. Do I hear an amen? Amen? Yes. We look inside that Hebrew text and it says that one language everybody spoke was Hebrew. And so people understood that friendship is yad yad. It's a clasping of hands, of course. That's what it means. There's something very special about friendship. And there's something very special about human hands clasping one another. Friendship. That's only one word for friend, yadid. Yad, yad, hand, hand. There's one more word for friendship used, and that is the word chaver. Chaver. You are my chaver. Now, that word is also interesting because contained within it is the Hebrew word for obligation. Now, once upon a time, a rather foolish film made the proclamation that love means never having to say you're sorry. I don't know about you, but I love my wife and I say I'm sorry more times than I like. No, it does mean having to say you're sorry. And friendship doesn't mean no obligations. Friendship doesn't mean that you're totally free. Friendship means an obligation towards one another. And the relationship is built on the passion and intensity of that sense of obligation towards one another. Think of the friendship shared by warriors. Have you ever watched old soldiers at a reunion? They have a relationship that nobody else on the outside can understand because they have faced challenge together. And they have fought for one another and protected one another. They've sensed the obligation. Special relationship of unity among people who share a challenge. You like the word love? You want to know where it comes from? Think about it for a moment. Isn't it odd? Virtually all people, if they want to speak about "I love you with all my elbow." No, "I love you with all my heart." Why? After all, this has been going on. If you look at poetry from 1,000 years ago, "I love you with all my heart." Why is it? Back then, we didn't even know the role of the heart in terms of the circulation of the blood. Why should people say, "I love you with my heart"? They could say, "I love you with my brain. I love you with my soul. I love you with my belly." You can say all kinds of things. Where did people all agree upon heart from? It's very simple. Because once upon a time, there was only one language and everybody knew it. It was Hebrew and everybody knew the Word of God. It was called Scripture and the Bible. And in there it says many, many times, "And you shall love the Lord your God with all your heart." That's what heart means. That's the expression of love. And people adopted that because it came from God's Word. And so that became an understanding of love. Where's the very first time that the word is love is used in the 5 books of Moses? Who do you think is described as loving another person? You think Adam is said to have loved Eve?
Well, I'm sure he did.
But it doesn't say so. So who loved who for the first time in the Bible? How about Abraham loved Sarah? What do you think of that? No. He probably did, but it doesn't say so. How about Noah loving Mrs. Noah? Let me tell you something, ladies. You spend 40 days and 40 nights on a boat with a guy, as my wife did with me. Love is got to be there. But it doesn't say it about them either. You know who it says it about? First time we find love used in the Bible? Abraham and Isaac, his son. Special relationship between a man and his father, right? Special relationship between a man and his father. If we have a relationship with our father, we are the most fortunate of men. And if we're able to have a relationship with our sons, we're even more fortunate. And Abraham loved Isaac, his son. Why? Shared challenge. They face the most terrifying challenge together. God says, "Abraham, you know that son you love? Take him, the one you love." That's right. "Take that son you love and offer him up. Bring him up for me." And Abraham and Isaac both misunderstood. They both thought God meant for Isaac to be slaughtered. Not every sacrifice has to be slaughtered. We all make sacrifices all the time. It doesn't necessarily involve slaughtering. Raising up to God doesn't necessarily mean killing. We can raise our lives up to God. And God said, "I want you to raise up Isaac to me." But in Hebrew, ha'alehu le'ola, elevate him, raise him up. But there's also another use of that word, sacrifice. Isaac and his father Abraham understood. What did they do with that challenge? Strange thing, you'll see in the book of Genesis, in the text, a funny thing. They're walking. Abraham and his son are walking to the Mount Moriah on which the terrifying event was going to take place. Abraham was now going to have to sacrifice his son, Isaac. This is the son he'd waited for so many years. His entire promise and hope for the future of the Jewish people rested with this one boy. But God said, "Hey, slaughter him. Got to do it. That's it. Done." And they're making their way laboriously. And then all of a sudden, the text says, on the third day, they saw Mount Moriah. Tell me something. I don't know about you, but I don't really care whether it was the third day or the second day. and the Bible doesn't have irrelevant information. Why should it tell us? I mean, maybe they got there in 6 hours. And you know something? If they hiked for 3 weeks, I don't really care. The basic story is they got there, they started the sacrifice, and God said, oh, not what I meant. But what was going on for the 3 days? And ancient Jewish wisdom, an oral tradition of 3,000 years, which is something everyone is familiar with. Yes? Well, I guess we all need a rabbi. What did they do? On the third day, what is all that about? It tells us that on the first day, Abraham and his son arrived and there was a terrifying forest fire blocking their way. What might a lesser person have done? Well, I guess, Lord, I've done my best, but I'm going home now. That's it. I wish we could go through. I'd go ahead and sacrifice my son. You know I would. But there's a forest fire. Sorry, pal. You know what Abraham and Isaac did? Walked right through it. Bang. That was it. Second day. You know what happens? I mean, this is written down in a book called The Midrash. Second day, they're walking along. All of a sudden, a massive flood. Water rushing. Sweeping away tree trunks, animals, boulders. A lesser man would turn his back on the challenge. Lord, I did my best. Sorry I can't succeed. Would have liked to have done it. But you don't expect me to drown in the flood, do you? So I'm going home. What did Abraham and Isaac do? Stepped into the water, walked right through it, out the other side and onwards to Mount Moriah. Third day, they're at the Mount Moriah. That's right. That is called seizing the challenge. What is the result of people who share a challenge together? Unity, friendship. People who share an experience, the greatest human experience of accepting a challenge, grabbing onto it, and marching forward, become united in a way that lesser people will never experience. I felt a little bit of this among you this evening, my friends, when Pastor Rice asked for us to take a few moments to greet one another. I found it very moving because I saw it was genuine. And that tells me that you are people who have seized the challenge together. You are people who have not turned your back on the gift of a challenge that the Lord has sent your way. Because seizing a challenge brings you into a state of closeness and harmony with another person that is never available to people who turn their backs on challenge. And that's why you will very often find husbands and wives speaking about one another to strangers, and they'd say, you know, he or she's my best friend. What do couples mean? When a woman says, you know, my husband's my best friend, even fills the gas tank of my car for me. What does he mean? Wouldn't you agree that one of the hallmarks of a successful marriage is when a man and a woman dedicated to one another, to their children, face the challenges of life together? There is no life into which challenge is not thrown, and you can face it arm in arm, or you can turn your back on it. Facing it brings you closer together. But friends, that's not the only thing that comes from seizing the challenge. There are great blessings that come from seizing the challenge. There are three great blessings that come from seizing the challenge. The first one is unity and friendship, the bond between human beings that come from seizing a challenge together. Because God created us to be givers, not takers. God created us in His image to be creators, not just consumers. I hate it, don't you, when industries call us consumers? Have you heard them say that? The consumer price index, I don't know about you. I'm a creator. I'm not a consumer. A squirrel is a consumer. A kangaroo is a consumer. I'm not a consumer. I'm a creator. And so is each and every one of you. Because we are created in the image of God, touched by His finger to be like Him. That means creators. And it is not possible to create without seizing that challenge. And seizing the challenge brings us not only unity, but it brings us the second blessing of seizing the challenge. The second blessing of seizing the challenge is deep happiness. Now look, we're already friends, right? We've been together for a few minutes so far. So you can be honest with me. Any of you ever felt depressed? Have you ever had things bring you down? Way down. Has that ever happened? Of course. You're living human beings. You are engaged in life. You are part of a vibrant, exciting, fervent church family. Of course you have faced depressions. You faced disappointments. You faced sadnesses. And you've been brought way down. What is the surest way to get out of a state of sadness, being down? The surest absolute way? Pop tablets. That's right. No. Absolutely not. Don't even dream of it. You do not want your rabbi to get angry. An angry rabbi is an ugly sight, I have to tell you. So we have a better solution. How do you get rid of sadness? We take a look again at the Lord's language, and we find that there is a certain pattern that links words in Hebrew one to another. A pattern that ties words together. For instance, in Hebrew, the word for mother and the word for child are linked together in a very special way. In Hebrew, the word for growth, achievement, accomplishment, is linked to the Hebrew word for happiness. The Hebrew word for happiness is simcha. And the avenue to that is the Hebrew word for growth, achievement, and accomplishment. Now, I don't know if you've ever had this experience, but if you haven't, take careful note of what I tell you now, because you will try it next time you feel way down. All you will do is pick yourself up and tackle the smallest job awaiting you. Whatever it is, tackle it. It might be going and working out. Go and lift weights till the sweat pours off you and your muscles are trembling with the tension. Guess how you're going to feel right after that? You're going to feel great, physically or spiritually? Spiritually. You're going to feel a sense of accomplishment. If you don't believe me, think of the opposite. Think of, well, this wouldn't apply to any of you. You all look in great shape. But think of a slightly bald rabbi who's eaten one good meal too many. I'm not thinking of anyone in particular. You go on a diet, right? And you stick to this diet rigorously. It's fantastic. And you're watching the pounds drop off and you're so impressed. And then one night you're working late. And you hear a voice calling you from that refrigerator. It's a chocolate creamy clegg. And it's saying, come here. Come here, I need you, I need you, you need me. And you go to investigate in that refrigerator and you pick it up and you open a chocolate cream pie pack and you eat a chocolate cream pie and you realize one isn't enough, so you have another one. And then you have a third one and you go back. How do you feel at that point? Happy or depressed? Don't you feel horrible? you have destroyed the achievement. You've destroyed the growth, you've destroyed the accomplishment. But the opposite is what's just as true. Build the achievement, build the accomplishment, build the sense of achieving something. Never mind the physical advantages, the spiritual advantage is that depression is banished and sent out the door, gone, no more sadness. That is how to overcome sadness. Find something that will need doing and do it. It'll give you a sense of accomplishment. A sense of accomplishment, a sense of growth brings you immediately a sense of happiness. Happiness cannot coexist with depression, right? It's not possible. Happiness comes in, depression goes out. Happiness is stronger than depression, but you have to know how to bring it. How do you bring it? You grow. How do you grow? The best way to get a sense of achievement, the best way to get a sense of growth, the very best way is to seize a challenge. Seize any challenge. That's why God sends them to you. They're little gifts. Let me give you an example of what I mean. I referred to my wife having spent 40 days and 40 nights with me on a boat. I enjoyed it very much. I'm not going to say she did. I think she went through two phases. The first phase was she was scared she was going to die. We were sailing from California to Honolulu, small sailboat. The second phase was she was scared she wouldn't. She just wanted it all to end. And when we got to Honolulu, everything was fine. Then dry land was great. And we spoke to several people who had also crossed over that summer from California, West Coast, crossed the Pacific to Hawaii, relatively small boats. And one of the folks had had a problem. As a matter of fact, it was quite a big problem. Their boat sank on the way. And thank God for the United States Coast Guard. Anybody got family members serving in the Coast Guard? Right. And the Coast Guard came, and the Coast Guard helicopter hovered over his sinking boat. The water was rising, and he and his family were clutching onto the boat. When all of a sudden, a crewman in the Coast Guard helicopter, big red and white beautiful bird overhead, he took a great big black thing and dropped it down on the boat. This big black thing plummeted down, and my friend says, I thought they were bombing us. I thought that instead of saving us, they were just trying to make sure we sank even quicker. He says, I was shouting all kinds of nasty things to that helicopter. How could they throw this massive object, this projectile? He says, just missed me. Would have hit me, would have killed me. Never mind drowning. Anybody know what that black thing turned out to be? As it hit the deck, it bounced off and hit the water. And as it hit the water, a hydrostatic switch activated and a carbon dioxide canister let loose. And there was a hissing noise and a great big beautiful rubber boat popped up. And they climbed into it. They thought it was a projectile. They thought it was a bomb. They thought it was there to destroy them. It was there to save them. How many of us have experienced a challenge coming at us? And what's our first sense? My God, what are you trying to do? Kill me? I don't have enough problems in life. And you turn your back. And what do you miss seeing as you turn your back? You don't realize that that projectile, that challenge has turned into the vessel of your redemption. Right? That's what happens to people who turn their back on challenge. I had a friend who arrived in America from a very primitive country. And he hadn't been here visiting with us for more than 2 or 3 days. When I was awaiting him to join me, so we were going to go somewhere to a game, and he wouldn't come. I went to his room, I knocked on the door, and I knocked on the door again. So I walked right in. And I see him, he's got a piece of string in his mouth, and he's pulling on the piece of string. What are you doing? And he says to me, my tooth is killing me, it's so sore, I'm pulling it out. I said, don't do that. What do you want to pull it out for? It's probably just a cavity. I've got a wonderful dentist. I'll take you to my dentist. And he said, what's that? I said, just follow me. I take him down to the dentist. Dentist sits in the chair, takes a look and says to me, yep, it's a cavity. I said, yeah, I knew that. And the dentist says to him, just sit still for a second. And he takes a syringe with some Novocaine. Thank God for the scientists who gave us Novocaine. Do you know how recently it was? I would say that in the time of the parents of many of us sitting here, dentistry was terribly painful. So now all you have to endure is a tiny little prick from the Novocaine shot, and from then onwards it's happy days. I mean, I know people who want to take some of it home with them. My friend from the primitive country sitting there, the doctor says, dentist says, open your mouth, opens his mouth, dentist takes a syringe, pokes him in the mouth. The guy lets out a, oh, and he turns on me with fury and he says, what are you doing? Before I just had a sore tooth, now it's even worse, I've got a sore gum. I'm out of here. And I said, don't you understand? It may seem like pain, but it's going to hurt for only a moment. It's like any challenge. And after that, if you face it and seize it, that becomes the vehicle for solving the problem. There's a lesson. That's the idea, friends. Challenges are easy to see as painful injections, easy to see as threatening and sinister projectiles. But the reality is, if you walk away at that point, you're missing the best part. Because a challenge is sent by God to be the vehicle for growth. And you seize that challenge and you grab onto it and you confront it and you battle it and you do what has to be done. And sometimes you bring in your friend to help you, and sometimes you bring in your pastor, you bring in your family, and that brings unity as well. And you conquer it and you solve the problem. The challenge has been defeated. And you feel a deep sense of inner happiness. And why shouldn't you? You're doing with that challenge exactly what the boss wants us to do with it. It's exactly how it works. That's the idea. The challenge requires courage. There is no question about it. And that courage, I told you before, is contagious. Stay close to people with courage, and that way you borrow some of theirs. And when you exhibit courage, when you refuse to show fear, the people around you grow. And it's because of you. You didn't show fear. How many times, men, how many times in your marriages are there situations where you want to just throw up your hands, give up, and just pour out all your fears and worries and hopelessness to your wife? Does that do anything? Yeah, makes her miserable as well. And when mama ain't happy, ain't nobody happy. Doesn't do any good. Now, if it would make you feel better, I'd say go ahead, do it. But it doesn't make you feel better either. Cowardice never makes anybody feel better. Only exhibiting courage and fearlessness makes you feel better. And that's what Moses said to Joshua. Be strong and of good courage. And that is a lesson that is offered to us again and again and again throughout the Bible. Let me give you just three quick examples. Noah building an ark. And the folks around him are saying, hey, Noah, what's up? What are you doing? Noah says, building an ark. The Lord's going to make it rain for 40 days and 40 nights. Going to flood you all away. And they said to him, Noah, listen, we don't know if you're right or if you're wrong. We don't know if it's going to rain for 40 days or 40 nights. What we do know is that it should it perhaps rain for 40 days and 40 nights. And should the sewers back up and the waters rise, we'll guarantee you one thing. You're not going to get aboard that ark alive. That's all there is to it. So now bang away as much as you like. Saw the wood, hit the nails, whatever you want. Just know that it's all for nothing. Because we don't like you. We've never liked you very much. We've always thought you had the strange habit of talking to God. So don't think you're going to go into that ark. The Bible uses an interesting phrase. Now, in Hebrew, the phrase is, and Noah and his wife entered the ark, be'etzem hayom hazeh. Now, it's a very difficult thing to translate because the concept requires several sentences. It's not as if it's just three words. In Hebrew, it's three words, but you need somebody to explain it. As a matter of fact, what I'd say is that you need a... Sure. I mean, Pastor, you don't mind me ingratiating myself so shamelessly with the congregation? Okay, good. And so, Noah hears the Lord saying, you must get in the ark, Noah. It's the middle of the day. Streets are full of people. So Noah says, Lord, I've got a couple of last minute things to do. Got a couple of mosquitoes haven't caught yet. Listen, I'll tell you what, I'll go in this evening. Now, what was in Noah's mind? Why did he really want to go in this evening? Because he was frightened of being seen. He didn't want the folks around who had threatened him to come out there and start bullying him and yelling him and beating up on him and maybe killing him and his family because they said, hey, you're not getting in that ark alive. And God said, I said now. And so the English translation in most Bibles usually says something like, on that self same day, Noah and his wife entered the ark. The trouble with that translation is it doesn't mean anything. What do you mean on that self same day? I thought it was that day, but it was another day. What does that mean? I don't get it. On that self same day, it's we've just become accustomed to it because you've read it in the Bible so many times, you don't think about it. You know, on the self same day. But, I mean, just, you know, don't lose your critical abilities just because it's the Bible. God wants us to understand every word. And it's on that self same day. Well, not exactly. You see, in Hebrew, it's be'etzem hayom hazeh. That means on the bone of that day. Bone as in skeleton. Now, what does the skeleton do for a human being? It stops us looking like jellyfish. It's what keeps us upright. It's what allows us to stand and face whatever is coming at us. That's the word. In Hebrew, that phrase, on the self same day, in Hebrew, be'etzem hayom hazeh, on that day, that phrase is used specifically to indicate that at this moment, superhuman courage is being expected from the person. Whenever you see that phrase, look out, and I'll give you two more examples so you know. Noah wanted to sneak into the ark when nobody was looking. You know what God said? Broad daylight, pal. As a matter of fact, just because of that, you're going to do it in rush hour. Simple. So Noah gets his family and they all go, they're sort of looking over his shoulders. Is there anyone there? God says, stop looking over your shoulder. Just get in that ark on this very day. Broad daylight, bang. People don't like it. Too bad. Yeah, Noah walked into the ark. Everything was fine for him. It wasn't too good for the other folks. On that self same day. Another time we see this happening, God comes up to Abraham. This was a real shocker. Abraham's hanging out with his son Ishmael. And God says, hey, Noah, Abraham, I need you to do a little operation on yourself and on Ishmael. Abraham says, sure thing, God, whatever you want. God says, I need you to circumcise yourself. I need you to take your procreative organ, take off the little... Say what? Excuse me? God says, you heard... Now, back in those days, you will be surprised to hear that there were people who worshipped the physical body. Never heard of such a thing, have we? Back in those days, people only thought about the physical body, not about the spiritual. And they regarded anybody who would do anything to the body as a violation of what they worshipped. And they did not allow folks in that area to do anything like a circumcision. Not allowed. Because you are tampering with the body's perfection. So Abraham says to God, Lord, listen, I live among a bunch of folks here. They don't really go with this idea. See, they think the body's perfect. You know, God says,
hey, I told you, I want you to circumcise yourself. Because I want you to understand, you are my partner in creation. I created you most of the way. And now I need you to help do the other part. You've got to do an act that will forever remind you that that organ is not a toy.
Abraham says, okay, Lord, if that's the way it's got to be, that's the way it's got to be. Tell you what, I'll start making all arrangements. I'll sterilize the knife. Should be ready to do it about midnight tonight. And God says, Be'etzem hayom azeh. Sorry, Abe. It's going to have to be broad daylight, and if you argue anymore, it's going to be in rush hour. You got to do it in broad. By the way, to this very day, Jews circumcise their sons on the eighth day only in daylight. Not allowed to do a circumcision in the nighttime. To this very day, it has to be something done proudly in broad daylight, not sneakily, hoping to surreptitiously do that circumcision after dark where nobody's looking. Broad daylight, you don't like it, tough luck. Be'etzem hayom hazeh, it's a strengthening experience. You do it, it'll make you stronger. Face up to your fears, grab that challenge. And it builds, it builds. And the last one, last instance. The Israelites ready to leave the land of Egypt. And the Egyptians have said, you've brought all these plagues on us and you've given us the darkness and the hail and everything else. And it's been terrible. One thing after another, it's destroyed our whole land and we've got nothing left. But we'll tell you one thing, you Jews, you're never getting out of this land. You try and set foot over the border and you will see. We will gather our last reserves of strength and you will die right there. Moses comes to the children and says, okay, everybody, time to go. God says, let's move. It's time to go. Be'etzem hayom hazeh. On that self same day? No, the bone, the strength, the skeleton, broad daylight. The people of Israel say, listen, how about we go after dark when they don't see us? That way, it's a terrific plan. They wake up tomorrow morning, Israel's gone, too late. God says, I don't want to do it that way. I want them to see you go, and I want them to see they cannot stop you. And the Israelites are shaking and trembling, and God says, you don't stop that, I'll leave you here for another 400 years. Quit that shaking. Well, I put that bit in. So what happens on that self same day? Yeah, be'etzem hayom hazeh. Demonstration of courage. Seize that challenge. And they did. They did. And out they went. And then, friends, not only does seizing the challenge bring you happiness, not only does it bring you unity, but seizing the challenge provokes miracles. Let me give you an example. Seizing the challenge provokes miracles. When you just sit around there waiting for something to happen, and you say, how come God doesn't want... Where's the miracle? Where's the love? I'm waiting. God, do something. God's response is, no, you do something. Where do we see some beautiful examples of this? Some great examples. Think, if you like, of the prophet Elisha. Elisha encountered a widow of one of the prophets who'd been neglected and left alone. She was all alone without a thing to eat in the house. And she finally, after looking around and seeing she had nothing, she came to the prophet who was her late husband's boss. And she said, is there anything you can do for me? And Elisha said, well, what do you got? She says, nothing. If I had anything, I would eat it. I wouldn't be disturbing you. And the prophet Elisha says, I want you to go back to your house. Search again. Bring me anything. The woman says, well, I told you there's nothing there. There's not even a piece of carrot. There's not a piece of bread. There's nothing. Elisha said, I don't care. You go back, search the house. Don't come back here till you got something. Everybody around there said, oh, where's the compassion? What's this prophet doing? Why doesn't he help the old lady? Pretty soon the lady comes back. What's she got in her hand? A tiny little bottle of oil. Elisha sees it and he says, ha, wonderful. And he takes it and he starts pouring. And he gets 50-gallon drums and he fills them up. And the water, the oil still keeps on coming. He pours. Another 50-gallon drum, fills it up. Another one. She became the first oil tycoon of the Middle East. Now look, I've got a question for you. Was this nature or was it a miracle? It was a miracle, right? Listen, if God is going to do a miracle to make limitless quantities of oil come out of a little bottle, don't you think he could also do a miracle to make limitless quantities of oil also come out of a thumb? So why couldn't Elisha have just said to the lady, bring your 50-gallon oil drums? Miracle! Filling up your drums. Because if the miracle has to be for you, you got to do something to make it happen. That's why. He didn't sit around and say, well, you sit there till the government comes and helps you. He didn't say that. He said, I am your partner in prayer. I am your partner in seizing the challenge. I'm here to help you, but you have to participate. Passivity is not a good thing. Don't just sit back. You go and search. That act of searching is seizing the challenge. She said, there's nothing. They said, I don't care. Go and search. It's the act of searching. And she comes back. She says, I know this isn't much. The house is empty. This is all I got. He says, wonderful. It's just what I wanted. Whatever she would have found would have sufficed. She found a little bottle of oil. That's fine. If she would have found a tiny little old gold necklace or earring, he would have turned her into a gold millionaire. It didn't matter. But she had to do something as well. That's the idea. You see a challenge, you got two choices. Turn your back on it, ignore it, sit down passive and wait for a solution. No. Get up and do something. I don't care what it is. Get up and do something. Because that brings the miracle. Go back to Noah. Right? Noah was saved from the flood by nature or by a miracle? A miracle, right? You cannot have two of all creatures and a whole family on a boat that only measures 150 cubits long for 40 days and 40 nights of rain, and then another year of waiting for the waters to subside. And during all that time, the boat didn't get overturned or didn't get sunk. Why? It was a miracle. God didn't. Now, if God's going to do a miracle, don't forget, this is a 600-year-old man. Major boat building projects, you know, not that easy. So once God already has to do a miracle for him, why doesn't God say, poof, there's an ark. Head on in, I just brought it for you. Because if that happened, Noah had no role in it. And so, yeah, you're 600 years old. Who cares? We don't believe in retirement. So what if you're 600 years old? It's time to start a 120-year boat building project. Because that is what will bring the miracle. That, friends, is exactly how it works. You seize that challenge. And you feel a deep inner happiness. You seize that challenge and you feel close to the people around you with whom you're facing the challenge. You seize that challenge and the black projectile turns into a rubber raft. You seize that challenge and the ark takes shape before your eyes. But you got to seize the challenge. You got to do the thing. I told you about hands. I told you about hands before. Hands, very special things. Hands, the basis of our imitation of God. God created us in His image. That means that we have the capacity to also create. And what is the symbol of our creativity? It doesn't matter what you do. Do you drive a bus? Do you build furniture? Do you type letters? Whatever you do, your hands are the symbol of your ability to create. And that's why no animal on earth has hands. They may have paws, but they don't have hands. Our hands are the symbol of God having created us. Now, when we're told that God created us in His image, what do we know? That He created us to be like Him. In what ways? Two ways. First way is, just as God is a creator, so are you. And you and you and me. We're all creators, not consumers. We're creators because we're created in the image of the greatest creator of all. That means we're also creators. But there's something else. God created us in His image. That means we are unique. Don't forget, monotheism means the worship of one God. That means we don't have thousands of idols. That means we're not like the Greeks with Mount Olympus, with a whole bunch of gods who behave foolishly like people. We have one God, and we know it's our job to learn to behave like Him. In fact, God brings a gift to the world of Christianity, which is the mechanism that brought millions to monotheism. Well, that is a powerful idea. Sure. Monotheism. One God. That means there's no other gods like Him, right? Means He's unique. How many people just like you? Not one. Not a single one. And God decides to give us a sign of our uniqueness. He gives us a sign, a spiritual sign directly from the soul that you have and I have and each and every one of us has that speaks to our uniqueness. And if our hands are the symbol of our God-given creativity, where do you suppose that God might put the sign of our uniqueness? What does the word fingerprint mean to you? Isn't that amazing? Now, if you don't think that's amazing enough, I'll tell you something really amazing. Identical twins have the identical DNA, right? The whole genetic code of an identical twin is exactly the same as his twin. That means they look exactly alike. They very often think alike. They sometimes behave alike. And very often the same things in life happen to them. Have you heard of that? They're exactly the same. So you would therefore obviously expect that since they have the identical DNA, what would you tell me about the fingerprints of two identical twins? The same, right? How can it not be? If they have the same DNA, there is no genetic code to say that one twin should have one fingerprint and the other twin should have another fingerprint. But my friends, here is a shocking piece of information. Identical twins have different fingerprints. Does anybody know how that comes about? And if you do, come tell me afterwards. We'll make a million because every university in the country would like to know the answer. Nobody knows. But I'll give you a hint. And that's because the fingerprint is not a biological feature. It's a spiritual feature. Right. And what that means is that that fingerprint is not a function of my DNA. It's a function of my soul. And even if I look exactly the same as my identical twin, we still have separate souls. His and mine. That, my friends, is how that works. We are creators. We are like God. We're not consumers. We're built to be givers. We're not built to be takers. We are built to grow because through growing, we become bigger and closer to God. And we do that through accomplishment, through seizing that challenge. And these three blessings flow to us from there. We seize that challenge. Each and every one of us with our own fingerprint, with our own hands in our own way. You each have the calling. Every one of us. I don't know what yours is. It's different from mine, just as your fingerprints are different from mine. Just as your soul is you alone and mine is me alone, your calling is yours. That calling is your challenge. That challenge is your vehicle to growth, and that growth is your vehicle to happiness. That vehicle is the growth to unity with friends, and that growth and that seizing that challenge is the gateway to your own special miracles. That's waiting there for each and every one of us. Don't be frightened. Chazak ve'ematz. Be strong and of good courage. Because one of the most exciting things around for which we can go down on our knees and thank God every day is that He sends us these challenges. And as I finish off, for I feel I've kept you here far too long already, I will do a small reenactment for you. I started off telling you about Dr. Benjamin Rush and how excited he was to see arm in arm, rabbi of the Jews, ministers of the gospel. And he said, this is a happy emblem for the future of our country. And so let me call up my dear friend, Pastor Rice, and let's do this little enactment. We want to show you what it looked like on the 4th of July, 1778. That's what we want. Pastor Tim? Okay. What Dr. Benjamin Rush, my friend, saw on that magical Independence Day in Philadelphia in the year 1788 was two ministers of the gospel arm in arm with a rabbi of the Jews. A most delightful sight and a happy emblem for the future of our country.
We sure need a. Anybody got a camera or a picture phone? Come on, get them out. Is that what you call it? There you go. Come on, just come right up front. There we go. Here we go. Filipinos have cameras.
There we go.
One more, just because I feel like my shirt. There we go. Can we just give the Lord praise for this wonderful man, for his wonderful wife? Thank you so much.
Thank you very much.
Such a delight.
Thank you,
Pastor Tim.
Thank you all.
Thank you. Listen.
Thank you all very much for the welcome. My wife and I have loved being in Nashville with you, and we sure hope that maybe we'll be invited back again.
How many of you want to have the rabbi back?
Okay. Thank you.
Oh. Well, tomorrow night we'll be back. It's going to be an exciting night, and there's so many great things that we want to continue to share. This was so amazing. I woke up this morning, he was supposed to leave, and I woke up this morning and it was like the presence of God was just right in front of me. I know this sounds a little strange, but just speaking that this is what you need to do. And I called the rabbi and he said, well, I'm sorry, I have to leave. And so I said, I just want to say something a little presumptuous. I said, what if we just thought of another alternative? You know, it's like, you don't know me that well to start changing my schedule. But I started saying, you know, we could fly your wife and do this. And I think just the energy, the desire to see what I knew was a special moment tonight. And I want us just to, as we're dismissed, whatever your prayer needs are, we've got ministry team to pray for you. But just take a moment. Come greet our friends. Give them a great hug. Tell them how much you enjoyed it. We love you so much. Pastor Tim, I'm just going to dismiss him. God bless you tonight. We'll see you tomorrow night, Friday night. It's going to be a moment for us. God bless you as you're dismissed.